From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, Washington State's immense landslide claims 14 lives with as many as 176 people still unaccounted for.
Her mom and her baby are missing up there. And we just kept on yelling for them, kept on seeing if we could hear anything, and we couldn't hear anything.
Also today, we examine President Obama's planned overhaul of the National Security Agency, find out why the US military involvement in the hunt for a Ugandan warlord has been described as a game changer, and we follow the landmark case involving Hobby Lobby, the Affordable Health Care Act, and contraception.
We never thought we'd see a day when the government would tell our family we could no longer run our business in a way that affirmed the sanctity of human life.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. U.S. President Barack Obama indicated Washington and the European Union are drawing up plans for targeted sanctions against Russia should the country's military stationed east of Ukraine advance into the country. Our correspondent Sandra Gatman reports from the Nuclear Security Summit at The Hague.
At the close of the two-day nuclear security talks, U.S. President Barack Obama was pressed to answer questions about the security situation in Ukraine and how the U.S. and EU could respond should Russian troops stationed on the eastern border decide to venture west. He said plans involved sanctioning Russian trade and business, but that countries were still assessing potential economic contagion. This after leaders of the G7 group of nations met on Monday without Russia to isolate President Vladimir Putin for supporting a referendum in Crimea and annexing the territory.
During the summit, the U.S. president was also focused on preventing terrorists from getting hold of highly enriched uranium or plutonium that could enable them to make so-called dirty bombs. He used a series of joint meetings to try and eliminate the material or secure it against theft. Mr. Obama told reporters that the key is to stop nuclear terrorism before it starts.
It is important for us not to relax, but rather accelerate our efforts over the next 2 years, sustain momentum so that we finish strong in 2016.
Meanwhile, six more bodies have been found by authorities in the U.S. state of Washington after a huge landslide buried around 30 houses in a small town. This brings the number of people known to have been killed to over a dozen. More than 150 remain missing, although authorities caution this may not represent the number of fatalities. Search crews have worked day and night, using helicopters and laser imaging following the movement of a large wall of mud which hit the town of Oso, north of Seattle. John Pennington, director of emergency management for Snohomish County, told NBC's Today Show that there is now little hope of finding survivors.
As we enter into day three, we see the devastation, and I think the realization is that we have responded as well as we can, and we will continue to do that, but that we are turning that very delicate corner into the recovery operation.
Clashes between police and angry relatives of passengers on board the missing Malaysian Airlines flight have taken place outside Malaysia's embassy in Beijing. It came after Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak said a new analysis of satellite data showed the plane had ended its journey in remote seas southwest of Australia, with the loss of all 239 people on board. China has asked to see the data on which Malaysia's conclusion was based. Many of the families are convinced that the Malaysian authorities have been incompetent in organizing the search and are distorting facts. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The Obama administration is set to propose new laws on what telephone records the National Security Agency can collect. The once-secret program was revealed by documents released by fugitive whistleblower Edward Snowden and angered many over the violation of their privacy. From Washington, Priscilla Huff reports.
The new laws would allow telecommunications companies to continue to collect metadata, the time and number of telephone and mobile calls, as they have in the past. But the National Security Agency would be required to obtain a court order to access those records, thus ending their bulk collection of the information. The NSA has claimed the records were key to their search for potential terrorists, tracking the phone calls suspects made. The Obama administration has not been able to confirm the metadata collection program has led to the prevention of a terrorist attack, and privacy advocates say there's no need for the government to place millions of Americans under permanent surveillance.
The U.S. is poised to deliver tens of millions of dollars worth of fresh assistance into Syria. That's according to a Foreign Policy magazine report. Quoting U.S. State Department officials, the report says Washington will send in ambulances, communication gear, and pickup trucks for Syrian rebels who have opened up a new supply route to the city of Aleppo. Nina Maria Potts has more.
The report in Foreign Policy magazine says U.S. State Department officials believe a fresh supply route to Aleppo from Syria's border with Turkey has been opened up by the Syrian opposition and will allow Washington to send in more aid. Even though Aleppo itself remains under siege from the Assad regime, American officials say the Free Syrian Army has managed to open up the route so that U.S. assistance can get into the city once again. The shipments are part of an $80 million non-lethal aid package to the Free Syrian Army.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
There is a house on 530 and a big slide, and it is covering the road at the bottom of Skaglen Hill.
What is it? A house?
It's a house. There was a big landslide.
A 911 call from a resident who witnessed the deadly landslide Saturday morning in Washington State. 14 bodies have now been found in the affected rural area north of Seattle. Authorities warned a further 176 people may still be unaccounted for as search and rescue teams battle through tough conditions. FSN's reporter Tim Exton visited the scene of the catastrophic mudslide and spoke to me earlier.
The current situation is that they're confirming that 14 people are now dead. The list of people possibly missing, and I would stress possibly, has gone up to 176. Other major developments are that the Washington National Guard is sending 50 people to assist in the rescue. There are already 150 first responders and volunteers taking part in the rescue. And unfortunately, a sign of where this is heading is that a state mortuary team has arrived in Arlington in anticipation of more bodies being recovered today and in the days to come.
When was the last survivor actually pulled to safety?
I think the last survivor was found on Saturday. Chief Travis Hotz, the fire department chief, is insisting that this is a parallel recovery and ongoing rescue, that there may be voids, pockets of air, where people could still be surviving, and that people have lasted this long. One of the other interesting developments is that cell phone companies are using what I can describe as ping technology to try to ping people's cell phones so they can pinpoint where either bodies or survivors could be. We don't have any details on how that is working and what that might produce, but I mean, I think this is, the idea of pinging is something that's very much in the news, and it's being used here to see if they can find both survivors and bodies.
Can you explain a bit about the affected area and why that number is as large as it is?
The number is as large as it is because there were at least 25 homes in occupancy that were covered by the landslide, up to 50 properties in total that may have had people in them. It was also that the mudslide occurred early on a Saturday morning when everybody was at home still and where visitors were also in the area. There were people who'd come to visit relatives. There was a satellite dish installing team that was in the area. There were people driving along Highway 530 who were caught in the mudslide. So it's a mixture of local people who lived in the area and people who were either visiting, working, or literally traveling through and just literally were there at the wrong time.
Tim, I know you've been speaking to people directly involved in that search and rescue effort. Can you tell us a bit about the conditions that they're working in?
The conditions are absolutely horrendous in terms of mud up to 20 feet deep. So it's very dangerous for the rescue. It's also very difficult to move. It can be very slow moving. Yesterday was a bright sunny day. The weather had been good since the mudslide, but today it's raining, which will hamper the rescue. And we have several days of rain forecast. And although that doesn't lead to any increased risk of flood, it really is the conditions for the rescuers and the recovery are just really, really appalling.
Must be shock and disbelief among those relatives and friends waiting for news on their loved ones. Can you tell us a bit about what sort of support are they receiving at the moment?
Well, the Red Cross, the American Red Cross, has been very active setting up centres for people to stay at, and the Snohomish County Emergency Management Office has been providing communications information. One other development is that the town of Darrington, which is the other side of the mudslide from Arlington and which had been somewhat cut off, they've reopened a road to there, and internet and telephone and communications have also been restored there, so people living there can get information, but it will also aid the communications needed to support a rescue and recovery operation of this scale.
Tim, has there been much discussion, any theories put forward on what may have caused this disaster, this mudslide?
Certainly the authorities here are very keen to get to the bottom of what caused this, and there are a lot of theories, and it could be multiple things. They believe the river may have undercut the side of the mudslide. There's certainly talk that this is one of the wettest Marches in history, and that amount of rain soaking into the ground was a contributory factor. And they also found that 100 yards from the side of the mudslide, there was a very small earthquake, 1.1 on the Richter scale, on Saturday morning before the slide.
FSN's Tim Exton in Washington State. This is FSN Reports. Ever since Edward Snowden began his revelations about the extent of spying by the US National Security Agency, many Americans have been concerned about just who is holding the so-called metadata details of their phone conversations and what's been done with them. Back in January, Barack Obama said he wanted the NSA to stop collecting call records in bulk while not sacrificing national security. He told intelligence officials and the Justice Department to come up with a plan to make that possible, and the details of that plan have now been published. Under the new proposals, phone records will stay with telecoms companies and can only be accessed by the government when needed. Lorna Shaddick spoke to Jim Lewis, a senior fellow and director at the Strategic Technologies Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, who began by giving her some more detail on what the new plan involves.
The big concern domestically has been with this 215 program, the metadata program, that allows NSA to have access to telephone records for some customers. Now, in my view, a lot of the concern has been overblown. They have about 320 primary targets, and those primary targets connect to another 5,000 or 6,000 people. So yes, they do collect millions of pieces of data, but they've only looked at a few thousand at most. That said, there's been a lot of outcry over this program. It always was a bit on the edge of being legal or not. And so I think you're going to see the 215 program greatly curtailed over the next year and probably eliminated.
In terms of the changes that are now going to be taking effect, the phone companies themselves will be involved a lot more in holding the data. And it seems to me, from what I remember, that many of them are particularly uncomfortable about doing that.
There's two parts to that. The phone companies already hold the data, right? It's your phone bill. So they've already got this data. NSA can always get access to it under a court order. It really doesn't change much. There's a little bit more of a delay in getting access because they have to go and get the court order, and not a big deal. What the phone companies don't want to hold is the liability. They're afraid that they'll be sued for the searches that NSA may conduct. That damages their reputation. That's what the phone companies don't want, and they have a legitimate ground for concern there.
Now, you were saying that this effectively does seem to mean the phasing out of the 215 program. What then was the need for it before, and why is that being allowed to change?
The 215 program was indeed useful. But of all the programs we have for surveillance, it is the least useful of those programs. There's a difference between useful and least useful. People will tell you there was no benefit from it. That's wrong. 215 played a role in stopping attacks against the United States, but it played the smallest role of all the surveillance programs. So given the uproar, I think the administration is willing to take the increase in risk from ending the program because the increase in risk is small. Maybe this increases the chances of a successful attack, but not so much that they're not willing to take that risk.
Can you go into a bit more detail about what is being potentially sacrificed here or not?
It will come as a shock to people, but what you see on television isn't how it actually works. What are these shows? Homeland? Is that one of them? It was really interesting to me because it didn't resemble an intelligence agency that I ever seen in action. These are team sports. You get groups of people from multiple agencies looking at fragments of data. Think of a jigsaw puzzle with 1,000 pieces where they only give you 200 randomly selected pieces, and from that you have to guess the entire picture. And you don't know which piece is going to be the one that's going to make you say, aha, I get it, this is what's happening. And that's where 215 plays a role. Giving it up is probably not that risky. It does increase risk, let's not kid ourselves, but apparently it's a risk that people are willing to tolerate.
James Lewis from CSIS talking to FSN's Lorna Shaddick. Now, the nation's highest court heard a landmark case today in which owners of for-profit corporations challenged their obligation to cover all forms of contraception in their employees' healthcare, as required by the Affordable Care Act. They said doing so would violate their religious beliefs, but attorneys for the Obama administration and women's health groups said an employer shouldn't be able to make those kind of decisions about workers' personal care, and warned a ruling in their favour could lead to a slippery slope in which religious CEOs refuse to cover all manner of healthcare services. Our Capitol Hill correspondent Alice Olstein was in the courtroom this morning and brings us this report.
As snow fell thickly on the marble steps of the Supreme Court, hundreds of activists from all over the country gathered to demonstrate both for and against the provision of Obamacare that says all insurance plans must cover preventative health care, including contraception. Lawyers for the Christian family that owns the arts and crafts store chain Hobby Lobby and the Mennonite family that runs the cabinet company Conestoga argued in court today that this mandate violates their religious beliefs. Anthony Hahn, the owner of Conestoga, told reporters outside the court that his rights under the 1993 Religious Freedom Restoration Act should exempt him from offering a complete health care plan to his nearly 1,000 employees.
We never thought we'd see a day when the government would tell our family we could no longer run our business in a way that affirmed the sanctity of human life, when the government would actually force us to be complicit to the potential destruction of human life. But sadly, that day has come.
Hahn and the other plaintiffs are asking the court for an exemption from covering certain forms of government-approved birth control, specifically intrauterine devices, or IUDs, and the so-called morning-after pill, which they believe are akin to abortion. But Marcia Greenberger with the National Women's Law Center says that belief doesn't square with reality.
Every mainstream scientific and medical organization and expert agree that the IUD and the morning after pill are forms of contraception. They prevent conception from happening. They are not abortifacients.
Also at issue in this case is whether corporations have religious rights that can be burdened or violated by government laws. The controversial 2010 Supreme Court decision, Citizens United, granted free speech rights to corporations, allowing them greater influence in elections. But Hahn's lawyer Paul Clement acknowledged that in this case, the court is moving into uncharted territory.
There's really no case on either side that says either that for-profit corporations definitely have religious exercise, and there's no case that says that they definitely don't.
Besides the idea of religious corporate personhood, several members of the court seemed skeptical of many of Clement's arguments on Tuesday. Justice Elena Kagan pressed him on whether corporations should also be able to claim religious exemptions from covering vaccines or blood transfusions in their health insurance, or even refuse to comply with child labor or minimum wage laws. Justice Anthony Kennedy, considered a powerful swing vote on the court, expressed concern for allowing the religious beliefs of the employer to trump the rights of the employee. And Justice Sonia Sotomayor pointed out that the government already gives religious employers a way out of covering contraception by letting them stop providing health insurance at all. Under the Affordable Care Act, employers can pay a tax that supports their workers getting plans on the individual market. And Sotomayor pointed out that it would be less than the company currently pays for health care. But Clement argued this wasn't good enough, saying the company would have to raise wages to remain competitive in addition to paying this tax. Many of the women's health, civil rights, and religious organizations that submitted amicus briefs to the court for this case said religious rights should not apply to corporations and should not trump democratically passed laws that promote public health. Reverend Peter Morales, the president of the Unitarian Universalist Association, told the crowd standing in the snow outside the court that Hobby Lobby and Conestoga are misinterpreting the Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
It does not mean that a wealthy and powerful employer can deny basic health care services and choices to his employees. That's not religious freedom. That's religious coercion. That's religious bullying.
The court is expected to rule on this case this summer. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Yesterday saw leaders of seven of the world's biggest economies suspend their dealings with Russia in the G8.
There is a strong historic bond between the two countries. But that does not justify Russia encroaching on Ukraine's territorial integrity or sovereignty.
President Obama, speaking at The Hague, said Russia could be in line for broader economic sanctions if Moscow further escalates the Ukrainian crisis. The US and EU have already levelled travel bans and asset freezes against officials as punishment for Russia's annexation of Crimea, a move Washington and its allies view as illegal. For more on the unease surrounding Russia's troop build-up along the eastern border with Ukraine, I spoke to Sabra Ayres from the Christian Science Monitor, who has been reporting from the eastern region of the country.
The thing that's happening in the east is that when I interviewed people there, they do feel a strong connection to Moscow. It's a lot stronger than most of their connections to Kyiv in terms of culture, mentality, language, and they do feel that what's happened in Kyiv on the Maidan was not what they would have chosen. But in the East, they have a very strong nostalgic sense for the Soviet Union. It's an area where there's a lot of heavy industry, a lot of coal mines, metal processing plants. And for these guys during the Soviet Union were treated as heroes. They were building communism throughout the Soviet Union, and so they received a lot of privileges and a lot of respect in the Soviet Union. So the older generations there remember that, and when the Soviet Union collapsed, it sort of left them in this sort of limbo where they all of a sudden lost their sort of social status.
Right.
And also a lot of their sort of economic status that they enjoyed during the Soviet Union. Even those that are work in the mines told me when I was out there that while they feel close to Moscow and they like Russia and they feel Russian, they see themselves more as Ukrainian citizens living within the borders of Ukraine. And they were talking more about wanting the country to have a referendum in which they could vote to have a bit more autonomy.
Right.
The separatist element in the East is not as strong as it was in Crimea. Although it does exist, it's a small fraction compared to Crimea.
Right. Okay. So perhaps Russian separatism isn't gaining ground, but what did people in those eastern areas say to you when you spoke about the troop build-up that Russia has continued along that border with Ukraine and the possibility of Russian boots on the ground? Was there a strong reaction to that?
Actually, they were not reacting to that as much as one would think. I think that I had some of them tell me, you know, if Russian troops were to be, if they were present in downtown Donetsk, which is, you know, a large city in the east, such as they were in Crimea, that would really scare a lot of people, and people were against that. Although they do have this sort of sense of, Russia has, you know, come in and helped the Russians in Crimea. They did sort of approve of that, but I did not hear from a large majority. I did hear from some, but not a large majority, that they wanted Russia to come in and save them, such as you heard in the Crimea, where they were telling me, we're glad the Russian troops have come here to help us and to save us.
Sabra Ayres, Ukraine correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Now, President Obama's decision to deploy additional US military resources to Uganda is being described as a game changer in the hunt for the warlord Joseph Kony. The US is sending 150 Air Force Special Operations personnel and at least four advanced Osprey helicopters. Kony, the leader of the Lord's Resistance Army, has abducted tens of thousands of children, forcing them to become child soldiers and sex slaves. From Washington, Daniel Renches reports.
Though these CV-22 Osprey aircraft are capable of a helicopter-style vertical takeoff, they also have the long-range, high-speed capabilities of a turboprop-winged plane. At least four are being deployed to enhance the US military mission to assist the African Union and regional government hunt for Joseph Kony. Sasha Lezhnev is a senior policy analyst at the Enough Project, a Washington-based pressure group which fights to end genocide and crimes against humanity.
The helicopters give the advisors and the African Union mission the ability to go and act on intelligence very quickly. These helicopters are they fly much faster than the other ones, and they also have the ability to carry personnel, and they can move in multiple directions. So that is really an important game changer for the mission.
150 Air Force Special Operations Forces are joining about 100 U.S. military personnel who were deployed for the mission in 2010. The new personnel are there to support the newly deployed aircraft. Sasha Lezhnev suspects Joseph Kony may be hiding out in border territory between the Central African Republic and Sudan. Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir has denied allegations that his government has provided support or sanctuary.
I think we really need more pressure on Khartoum to end any support or even any sanctuary. It's technically a contested border region, so the legality, I think, is a little bit unclear at the moment. Certainly a massive troop presence would not be welcome, but this is an African Union mission, and so we need the African countries to weigh in with Sudan as well.
Figures from 2006 estimate that Kony and the LRA has been responsible for abducting up to 66,000 youth, turning them into soldiers and sex slaves. The International Criminal Court has accused the LRA's top commanders of murder, abduction, sexual enslavement, mutilation, the mass burnings of houses, and looting of camp settlements. Earlier this month, America's United Nations Ambassador Samantha Power reflected on progress made in isolating the LRA militarily and on the goals of offering humanitarian support and protection of civilians.
It is encouraging as well that the LRA has been forced to break up into small groups and that in 2013, the number of their attacks went down. The level of deaths and abductions attributable to those attacks, however, remains far too high. The world must not rest until Joseph Kony and his clique have been held accountable and the LRA has become just a horrible memory.
The issue of Joseph Kony and his use of child soldiers was brought to the attention of President Obama by his younger daughter, Malia, according to White House aides.
And its only purpose is to stop the rebel group, the LRA, and their leader, Joseph Kony.
Many young Americans were influenced by the viral campaign video, Kony 2012, which prompted the U.S. Congress to pass a law authorizing a military deployment.
They want this mission to succeed, and so if the Obama administration actually helps end the LRA war, it's a major foreign policy success, particularly among America's youth.
Current international efforts are having a major impact, reducing the number of Lord's Resistance Army attacks by around 50% since 2008. Since 2012, two of the LRA's top five commanders have been removed from the battlefield, and the U.S. State Department says it's received credible reports from several defectors that Okot Odhiambo, the LRA's second-in-command, was killed late last year. Some recent estimates suggest the overall LRA force has now been reduced to around 250. Daniel Rensches, Washington.
And that's the Tuesday edition of FSN Reports. Remember, you can tell us what you think of the show by emailing us, reports@featurestory.com. And you can always get in touch via Twitter. We're there, @FeatureStory. Coming up on Wednesday, the South African entrepreneurs shaking up Silicon Valley. That's Wednesday. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks, Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.